Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this expert session on trends in audio and acoustic signal processing. I'm very glad that so many of you came, and thank you already in advance for postponing your lunch break a bit. I hope we will make it interesting. I was just recently notified that we could also use this opportunity to do some advertisement for our TC, which is the TC on audio and acoustic signal processing. As I'm not really prepared for this, so please take the whole thing as advertisement for our TC. And whoever wants to get involved, please contact us. There are various ways of getting involved in our activities. And of course, we first would like to tell you about what this is. So I'm here in my role as a past chair of this TC, and I would like to present two experts, which are also from our TC, which represent the acoustic signal processing community and the audio community in a very specific and, I think, very renowned way. I would first like to point to Patrick Naylor. Please come step forward so that you can be seen. Patrick Naylor is from the Imperial College in London, and I think the most important thing about him right now is that he just recently co-edited the first book on speech to reverberation. And for everything else, you might look at his websites, which has also very nice pictures, I can tell you. And on the other hand, I have Malcolm Slaney, who is well known for the audio and music especially community, and his scope goes actually much beyond that. He is from Yahoo Research, and I should not forget to mention that actually both have ties to both worlds, though Malcolm is also teaching at Stanford and Patrick also has industrial relations. So without further ado, I would say Patrick should start.
Well, thanks very much for coming along to this session. We hope it's going to be interesting to you. We tried to think about what you might expect from this kind of session, and I have to say that the idea of trends is a very personal thing. So we're going to present what we personally think are hopefully interesting things, but obviously in the time concerned, we can't cover everything. So some of these things are like very easy to define, like counting papers as a measure of activity, or counting achievements maybe in terms of accepted papers rather than submitted papers. Some of them are much less cloudy or nebulous, and they're more softer concepts. But we'll try to go around this wheel a little bit and see what we can find. So the first thing we did was to look at the distribution of submissions to the transactions on audio, speech, and language processing, and try to plot this out. There's a lot of detail on this pie chart here, but the thing to notice from this is that there are some big subjects which are very active within our community in terms of the amount of effort going into them. So speech enhancement is a big one and has been for a long time. Source separation continues to be very active. We've had ICA sessions here at ICASP. Microphone array signal processing, still very big, and showing up something like 13% of submissions. Content-based music processing, let's just call it music processing. Music is huge for us now. Music is huge for us and continues to grow at a rate of knots. And this is a real evolution that we're seeing, maybe even a revolution in our profile of activities. Also, we could look at audio analysis as a big topic. The ones that I've highlighted there are the ones that we're going to try to focus on in this session. As I mentioned, we can't possibly focus on everything. So that leads us to music.
So music has become very big here, as Patrick mentioned. And this year at ICASP, there are three sessions that you can see listed there. There's a number of reasons that I thought were worth highlighting, just because it's interesting to see how the community develops. Certainly one of the reasons is that the edicts, which is how people describe what papers they're submitting or describe the papers they're submitting to a conference, was changed to include music as an option. So it's a rather bureaucratic reason, but probably has a large amount to do with the fact that there's so many music papers now at ICASP, and obviously I think that's a good idea. A second reason is there's a lot more content to work with. Music's easy to work with. There's a lot of, you know, we all own large collections. And the third reason is it's become very commercially relevant in the last few years. So iTunes and Pandora are certainly two examples of companies who are making a large amount of money from music ideas. As I mentioned, the data is easy. We all have large CD collections. And one of the things that is difficult about music is it's all copyrighted, or all the stuff that we want to work with is copyrighted. And one way that the community has dealt with this is by doing a competition, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But another way that the community has worked with these copyright issues is to create what's called the Million Song Database. And the idea of this is to distribute features of the songs, not the actual copyrighted material. And so, actually, I forget how many features there are. I think it's on the order of 100 features per song, and they're over time, too. And Columbia and Echonist provide this database. It's online. And there's a lot of data there that people can use, and it's freely available, and it's a very large database. And I expect we'll see more and more papers that use this database. The MIRIX competition has probably been the best thing for the scientific component of music analysis and music processing. This is the list of tasks that are being worked on for the 2011 competition. As I mentioned, copyright's a big issue, and what the MIRIX people do is provide an environment at the University of Illinois where people can run their algorithms on a large database of songs. So the songs never leave the University of Illinois. So instead of getting data and doing your algorithms and sending the results back, you send your algorithm to the University of Illinois in a particular environment, a Java environment, and they run it, or they debug it, they help debug it for you. And then they run the algorithm on their machines, on their clusters, and give you back results. I wanted to highlight three tasks that are shown in red here that are very important and very popular. One is audio tag classification. So how do you tag audio with various things? Is it happy? Is it blues? Anything you can think of can be a tag, and people work on that very hard. Multiple fundamental frequency estimation and tracking has been popular at ICASP before MIRIX started, but MIRIX has I think, provided a common database and really upped the scientific level, because now people can compare things on their own. And the other one is audio chord estimation. So in a sense, a chord is just another tag, but it's a very specialized tag, and it helps people understand the music, and people work on that a lot. Something else that's happened, and it's been very evident this year, is a lot of work on separation analysis, and they're all very model-driven approaches. So this particular graphical model is from a paper by Maezawa, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, and it shows a sequence of notes along the top, and so in this case they have a score, they know what's being played, and that's not hard information to get. And then they're generating data about the harmonics from here. So you have the amplitude, the F naught, and the variance of the Gaussian in the spectral domain, that are combined. And then you have some emission probabilities, and so these are the spectral slices. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to, given the note sequence you have, build these emission probabilities that describe the music. And from that, you can do a lot of a very interesting work. You can also do things like tagging, which I mentioned, for things like emotion and genre. And something that's kind of dear to my heart, but shows you the kind of work that's being done in this area, some work on morphing. And the question that Caetano and Rodet wanted to ask was, what's the right way to think about audio perception and in morphing? And so if you do morphing correctly, then the path in feature space should be a line. So if you're morphing between one position and another position, that feature moves along a line in the visual domain. And you want the same sort of thing to happen in the auditory domain. So the graphs that's shown here on the left, and I'm sorry for the poor quality, but just give you a sense of it, are a range of line spectral frequency envelopes. And then on the right-hand side are the perceptual measures that have been used or have been calculated based on these LSFs. And what they're doing is trying to look for one that's a straight line, which you can see in the middle there. And some features work better than others, and I think that research is still being pursued.
Great. So our audio and acoustic signal processing, TC, covers quite a wide range of areas, which are, well, I have to say, to me they're exciting. I hope you feel also that same excitement about the technologies that are being developed. And I think we see trends that a lot of the technologies that have been in the laboratory for many years are now starting to come to the point of applications, industrial applications, and we've heard about some of these in the plenaries. And in that kind of context, if we look at the research that we do, I ask the question, how much of it is driven by the desire for exciting applications, and how much of it is fundamental, how much of it underpins the technology with good algorithmic research. So I asked, is there a happy marriage here? And I hope the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge will forgive me for using their photograph. But there is a serious point behind this. But before we come to the serious point, of course, Prince William is very, very pleased, having now found his very fine bride. So he's maximized his expectations and had a very happy day. Coming back to something a little bit more serious, I think things which look good have to be underpinned by excellence in algorithmic and fundamental research. So if there is a trend, perhaps, towards things that look great, let's just not lose sight of the fact that the power behind them is the algorithms that we develop. Okay, so one of the areas of algorithmic research which is very hot and has been for a long time is in array signal processing as applied to microphones, maybe also loudspeaker array signal processing. And here we see an evolution of applications. Hearing aids has been very busy for a long time and has many applications as well as excellent underpinning technology. I do see now a big branch out into the living room. And the living room means TV, it means entertainment, perhaps it means an Xbox 360 with a Kinect microphone array, perhaps it means Skype TV. So these are new applications which are really coming on stream now, and I think will start to shape the way that we do research. The tasks haven't changed that much. We still want to do localization, we still want to do tracking, we still want to extract a desired source from many, be they noise or other talkers. And a new task is to try to learn something about the acoustic environment by inferring it from the multi-channel signals that we can obtain with a microphone array. And this gives us additional prior information on which we can condition estimations. Another issue is what kind of microphone array should we use and how can we understand how it's going to behave? People started off perhaps looking at linear arrays, certainly extending it into planar and cylindrical and spherical, even distributed arrays that don't really have any geometry. And the design of such arrays, including their spacing of microphone elements and their orientation, is an important and expanding topic, I think. People started off with linear arrays, a bunch of microphones in a line. Perhaps this is the well-known EigenMic from MH Acoustics, 32 sensors on the surface of a rigid sphere, 8 centimeters or so. Those are the laboratory prototypes, the laboratory products that come now into real products you can buy and connect to your TV. So Skype TV offers the opportunity to include microphone arrays for relatively low cost, such that you can communicate using your living room equipment for very low cost communications and hardware. And the challenges here are that you're probably sitting 4 meters away from the microphone. So this is going to be, I think, a really hot application for us in the future. Interestingly, people are still doing fundamental research, so I'm pleased to see that. And here's a paper I picked out, I can't say at random, but it caught my eye. Here's a problem. Given N sources and M microphones, where should you put the microphones? Yeah. And in this work, which is some work I spotted from the Oldenburg group, given a planar microphone array, some analysis which enables one to predict the directivity index obtained for different geometries, and therefore obviously then allows optimization of those geometries. Okay, so source separation is another hot topic and has been for a while. I thought I should say that obviously trends start somewhere. The trend has to begin with a trend setter. And I put this photograph up of Colin Cherry simply because I think he used to have the office which is above my office now. So I ought to feel some kind of proximity effect. His definition of the cocktail party in his 1950s book on human communication is often quoted in people's papers. And the early experiments were asking the question as to the behavior of listeners when they were receiving two or more simultaneous signals, and called that the cocktail party. The picture here, I've put it up on purpose because I don't think many people would really have a good image of what a cocktail party was in 1950. So I guess it looks a bit different now. So progress in this area has led us to be able to handle cases where we have both determined and underdetermined scenarios. Clustering has been a very effective technique. The permutation problem has been addressed with some great successes as well. And now we're starting to see results in the practical context where we have reverberation as well. The usual effect of reverberation is talked about in the context of de-reverberation algorithms for speech enhancement. And this is something that I've myself tried to address. And perhaps we're now at the stage where there is a push to take some of the algorithms from the laboratory and start to roll them out into real-world applications. And perhaps we'll then learn whether they work or not. And we have to address the cases which are both single and multi-channel cases, often by using acoustic channel inversion, if we can estimate acoustic channels. And although this is on a slide titled Speech Enhancement, of course, reverberation is widely used both positively and has negative effects also in music. So let's not lose sight of that as well. The other factor which I wanted to touch on here was synergies. So interdisciplinary research is often a favored modality. And in our community, we can see some benefits coming from cross-fertilization of different topic areas, for example, of dereverberation and blind source separation. And we start to see papers where these are jointly addressed with some good leverage from both types of techniques. Equally, speech dereverberation coupled with speech recognition, where a classical speech recognizer is enhanced such that it has knowledge of the models of clean speech, but also has models for the reverberation. And by combining these, is able to make big improvements in word accuracy.
So I want to talk a bit about a recurring theme that I've been seeing over the last few years, both in this community and elsewhere, but I thought I'd mention it here first. And that's about sparsity. And no, we're not talking about my hair. The first place I saw this was in the matching pursuit work that was presented here in 97, I think, but it was first done in a signal processing transactions in 93. And at the time, I thought it was interesting, but a dumb idea. And so now I'm going to correct myself. But it's shown up in a number of interesting places in the work that has been done at ICASP and elsewhere. Compressed sensing a few years ago was probably the best example. But in this community and the machine learning community, sorry this is so low, just says deep belief networks. Sparsity has been a big part of the work that's been done on deep belief networks and machine learning, and I think that's been interesting. And in a lot of papers that we saw this year, L1 regularization is a way of providing solutions that make sense when you have a very overdetermined, very complex basis set. And so I title this all sparsity, but it's probably better described as sparsity in combination with over-complete basis sets. And I think that combination is interesting. One example of that was talked about a little bit ago in the session before this, in the work by Nima and Shiab, using a cortical representation to model sound. And cortex is probably the original sparse representation. It predates all of us. And the idea is that you want to represent sound with the least amount of biological energy. And what seems to work well there is to use spikes that are representative of very distinct sound atoms. And how that's all put together is still a matter of discussion. But I think it's going to be interesting. And the way Nima has been using that is to take noisy speech and put it through these kind of this very overcomplete basis set, and then filter it in regions that are likely to contain speech. And so, in a sense, it's a Wiener filter, but it's in a very rich environment where it's very easy to separate speech from noise and things like that. And what's shown in the bottom is noisy speech, the kind of filter that makes sense for speech, which, for example, has a lot of energy around the 4 hertz modulation rate, and then the cleaned up speech on the output. The deep leak networks are interesting, I think, for a similar reason. This all ties together. What's shown on the left-hand side is a little bit of a waveform that's being applied to a restricted Boltzmann machine, which is just a way of saying that they're going to learn a weight matrix that transforms the input on the bottom here to an output shown on the top there through a weight matrix. And there's a little bit of a nonlinearity there. And they can learn these things in a way that can reconstruct the input. So they're trying to find basis vectors on this side, or represented by the weight matrix, so that given one of these guys, they can reconstruct the visual units. Oops, sorry. And these are some, they've been doing this for the image processing domain for a long time. And these are some results in the waveform domain that are new this year. And there's a bunch of interesting things that often look like Gabors of various sizes. But the one thing that's interesting is you also see some very complex features. So this is in the frequency domain, and you've got these things that have two frequency peaks, which, you know, might be akin to formants. And so they've been applying that to speech recognition, and I think that's an interesting direction. I'm going to go out on a limb here, because I think the reason that sparsity is important is it because it gives us a way of representing things that we can't do as well in other domains. So we all grew up with the Fourier transform domain. And what's shown on the left-hand side are two basis functions, basis 1 and basis 2, just two different frequencies. And with those two basis functions, you can represent the entire subspace. And so that point that's shown there can be anywhere in that subspace, and you can do all those things. And it's a very rich representation. And as we all know, you know, as long as you satisfy the Nyquist criteria, you can do anything. But I think that's the problem with a dense representation like that. And the alternative is to look at something like an overcomplete basis and just pick out elements that you've seen before. So these are just some synthetic formants. But the way I like to think about these things working is that if you train, if you build a system that exploits sparseness, whether it be a deep leaf network, whether it be matching pursuit, whatever your favorite implementation technology is, you're going to learn patterns that look like these formants. And so what's shown on the left is one vowel with different vocal track lengths. And on the right-hand side is a different vowel with different vocal track lengths. And the system on the right with a sparse overcomplete representation is just going to learn these kinds of things. It's going to learn vowels with different vocal track lengths. And it's not going to learn the entire space. And so then if you want to process things, if you're working in this space, then only things that are valid sounds, sounds that you've seen before, will be represented by this sparse basis set, and you can do useful things. And so I think that's where it's going to be an important trend and important direction for our community.
So one of the things we wanted to do is to go out to different sectors of our topic area and pull in some hopefully interesting quotations from leaders in those fields. So here's one that comes from from NTT. So here we have a telecommunications company. Thank you to Tomohiro Nakatani for this quote. Remaining challenges in source separation could include blind source separation for an unknown or dynamic number of sources. Notice that I artificially inserted Colin Cherry's photograph on the wall of their laboratory there. So. Into the hardware area. So if we think about mixed signal ICs, the guys that are working on those functionalities really support what we want to do. So I think that it's important to listen to the hardware guys as well. So from Wolfson Microelectronics, Moore's Law is driving DSP speed and memory capacity, enabling implementation of sophisticated DSP functions resulting from years of research. The end user experience, maybe this is a wish rather than a reality at the moment, the end user experience is one of natural wideband voice communications devoid of acoustic background noise and unwanted artifacts. Seems to me like the hardware manufacturers are on our side. We heard a little bit this morning about the Xbox Kinect. Ivan Tashev, thanks for this contribution here. The applications of sound capture, enhancement, and processing technologies shift. Now, here's a paradigm shift. Shift gradually from communications, which is where they were originated and have their home, towards recognition and building natural human-machine interfaces. And he highlights mobile devices, cars, and living rooms as key application areas. Malcolm, you get the last word.
Well, I don't want the last word, but we have one more slide, and we can't decide whether this is the last word from Steve Jobs or from Lady Gaga. But in either case, the message is the same. And there's large commercial applications for the work that we're doing. It started with the MP3, which enabled this market, but there's still a lot of things to be done in terms of finding music, adding music to things, understanding what people's entertainment needs are. So we really haven't talked about that very much. But this is not an information retrieval task. You know, people are looking for things to entertain themselves, and whether it be songs or music or whatever, understanding these signals and working with them is an important thing to do. And so I think both Lady Gaga and Steve Jobs can have the final word. So thank you.
So thank you, Malcolm and Patrick. Now we have very little time for discussion, but we certainly should not miss this opportunity to hear other voices as well. As Patrick mentioned, obviously, these views are not completely balanced. How could they be? So maybe somebody in the floor would like to add something, and we can maybe have a little discussion on more. Anybody? Yes.
Thank you for that great summary. I just want to add one more thing. I think we have two eyes and two ears, and they work together. And I think cross-modal issues are likely to be very important. The eyes direct the ears, and the ears direct the eyes, and so on. And likewise, I think audio research and vision research should not proceed separately.
Thanks, Imani, for this comment. This is certainly something which we highly appreciate, and we always like to be in touch with the multimedia guys who don't see audio as a media. But certainly there are many applications where we're actually closely working with video persons. Just think of source tracking. So if you want to track some acoustic sources and the source is silent, then you better use your camera. Right? So there are quite a few applications where this is quite natural to join forces. Maybe Malcolm?
Just to reinforce that, there was a nice paper I saw yesterday. I don't remember who did it, where they were looking for joint audio visual sources, and I think that's important. And it's going to be easier. I mean, the signals are no longer a big deal, so it's easy to get to this space. The computer power is pretty easy. It'll be fun.
People have two ears. Is there any research? Use a binaural signal processing for binaural for music signal processing.
So the question was whether there's any binaural music research. I don't know of any. I mean, people certainly worry about synthesizing high fidelity sound fields. So the Fraunhofer group, for example, has been working on synthesizing, you know, sound fields that sound good no matter where you are. And certainly I work with people in Stanford who are very interested in creating 3D sound fields for musical experiences. But I'm not sure where that's going to go yet. I mean, I if you'd asked me 10 years ago whether everybody had 5.1 speakers in the living room, I would have said no. But look what's happened. So it'll be better. Anything else before lunch?
Okay, you talked about 5.1 speakers in the living room, but we're seeing a lot of new algorithms that'll do microphone array processing. Will we be seeing devices that'll let us do it? I mean, the Microsoft Kinect has a few microphones. I've seen a few cell phones that have multiple microphones on them for noise cancellation, but will they have more devices that'll allow us to do, you know, better processing algorithms?
Yeah, so the question was, will we have devices that will have the ability to allow us to implement, yeah? So APIs and so on and so forth. I understand from this morning's talks that APIs will be, software development kits will be available for Kinect, and that could be a lot of fun. I think the hardware is there to enable us to do it, and the key point out of this, I think, is one of the trends that we certainly see, which is a move in audio from single to multi-channel. And that's been happening for a while, and there's no sign of it stopping. So we would expect the facilities, the processing power, the interoperability, and the software development kits to come with that as well.
Any other question? Comments? I have one final remark, which came up increasingly, and I would like to put that as a challenge, because there are sensor networks are out there, and they are in discussion in many papers, where nice algorithms are provided, always based on the assumption that all the sensors are synchronized. This is a tough problem, actually. So. And we feel in the audio community we could benefit a lot if somebody could really build devices which make sure that all the audio front ends in distributed devices work synchronized. The underlying problem is simply that once you correlate signals of different sensors that have not exactly synchronous clocks, this correlation will fall apart. And just look at all your optimization and all the adaptive filtering stuff that we have. It's always based on correlation and even higher order statistics sometimes. But then this problem has to be solved. So if you want to do something really good for us, then please solve this problem.
After lunch.
After lunch. Okay. Thank you very much for attending.